In Vancouver, I am Plante on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. You might have already heard of his story online or on television. Michael Schroeder has already been featured on the local news for his forthcoming circumnavigating of the world by bicycle. He leaves Vancouver the 1st of August on a journey that will take him 40,000 kilometers, 6 continents, and 30 countries. He leaves behind two careers. He's an elementary school teacher, and he is a 24 Hours paper social columnist. He does so to raise awareness about mental illness by sharing his own story. Michael is bipolar. He already shatters stigmas around it, what with his two careers, and now with this bike ride, he sets out to do more by taking us along for the ride via Facebook and Twitter, by documenting his progress, and by talking about mental illness frankly and openly. The Canadian Mental Health Association endorses and benefits from this journey as he funds this year-long adventure himself. Do as I have and go to ridedonthide.com to read more and donate. The mayor, Gregor Robertson, has already declared August the 1st to be Ride Don't Hide Day. That's when he sets off on this journey. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Michael Schroeder. Good morning, Mr. Schroeder.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. You've always wanted to ride the world, ride around the world on a bike, have you?
I grew up in a family that loved biking. My brother and I got to enjoy several trips with my mom and dad and stuff like that. And then as a late teen, young adult, it was 1993, I cycled across Canada and got to St. John's, Newfoundland, and swore to myself that one day I would cycle around the world. So it was 94 I cycled across. So that dream of cycling around the world was 16 years old.
Are you scared at all doing this?
I'm not scared of the ride itself. I mean, you know, you take your safety measures and you're cautious. You know, got my helmet. I'm a cautious rider. And then after that, my philosophy is you try to live life to the fullest, and that's all you can do, right? To sort of be afraid of something that's inherently, I don't think, something to be afraid of. No, but you know, it's ironic, Joseph, that you said, "Are you afraid of this?" I feel anyways. The fear and the misconceptions around mental illness creates such a stigma that I find this interview, this acknowledgement of the fact that I've dealt with mental illness and I'm dealing with mental illness, far more scary than hopping on a bike for a year.
This being able to talk about your own illness, how long has this been for you easy to do? I mean, is it? I mean, now?
Yeah. No, it isn't. It's getting easier. I guess 3 months, 2 months. It's all been a bit of a whirlwind, and I'm very grateful for the media attention. So it's almost like it's been forced upon me, and that first time sort of talking about it to someone outside of my immediate friends and family would have been about 2 months ago. And I remember consciously thinking then, like, it's almost like you're coming out of the closet, man. Like, there's no turning back now. To put it frankly, I just believe so strongly in the ridiculousness of the stigma that I'm willing to take my chances and be open about my own, about myself.
You understand the fear of discrimination. Did that happen to you?
You know, a little bit, but I've been blessed. I've had a great support network and so forth. I think when you look at the extremes of mental illness, of people that have fallen through the cracks, when you see, you know, some unfortunate souls on the on the streets, I think there we can glimpse at what it would be like to be shunned, you know, to be ostracized to the point of. You know, it's just unbelievable that here we are in the third millennium in a wonderful country that we call Canada that this still goes on, you know. We've come a long way. We're no longer lobotomizing people or burning them at the stake, and there's been a lot of progress in the last 5, 10, 20 years in coming to an understanding of this ailment. But I think we've got a long way to go. Unfortunately, the stigma is being perpetuated in the sense that but most people are ashamed and stay silent, and, you know, don't talk about it. So then the question is, well, who's telling the story of mental illness? Who's educating the layperson, the public? And in my opinion, I think it's the Hollywoodization of the mentally ill, and the sensationalistic sort of tendencies of media. So if we go to the Hollywoodization, and Hitchcock was a brilliant director, and I loved his films. You go to Psycho with Anthony Perkins, and hence the slasher film was invented. And it's completely natural for us to all want to be scared, and this is why roller coasters exist, and this is why we go to horror movies. And quite frankly, there's nothing more, I guess, frightening than a human monster. So when that genre is, started, and then you see it evolve to all the way up, from Jason from Friday the 13th, Mike Myers from Halloween, to Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, this is educating the public on something that's taboo. And because it's educating the public, then there's more shame and more taboo. Then you walk out of the theater and, you turn on your news, which is, of course, supposed to be the storytelling machine of truth, right? And, the mental ill that make the newspapers, that make CNN, are guys that go berserk with, a machine gun in a shopping mall. So there's the other sort of education of the public of what mental illness is about. Basically, you're dangerous, I guess, and that you're volatile and you're going to hurt people. And so hence the 99.999% of people that are dealing with mental illness that are just getting on with their lives, that are mothers, fathers, taxi drivers, bakers, lawyers, whatever, just continue to sort of not advocate for themselves because they're too ashamed to be associated with the crap that they see in the movies and in media, in the news.
Now, in your situation, you think that talking about it has helped you. Some people, though, probably wouldn't find comfort in that. So how do we get away from the stigma of it all?
Right. Well, I don't think hiding any part of your personality is particularly healthy. And at the same time, and I understand that there's a time and place for talking about personal issues. When someone asks you, you go into the office and say, how's your day? You're not going to say, well, I just had a manic episode last night. I mean, yeah. I understand that. I'm going way out here with this and with the ride. I think the only way that we can get beyond the stigma is to talk. People have to see the humanity in mental illness. If the Canadian Mental Health Association is correct, they say 1 in 5 are momentarily in life, temporarily, longitudinally affected by mental illness. And the American organization of the equivalent says, 1 in 6, and somewhere, in England it's 1 in 4. So basically, it's all around this number, 1 in 5. So, let's say we're completely wrong. I mean, by a factor of 2. So let's say 1 in 10. Let's say 1 in 10 people are touched by it. Well, in a city of 2 million, which Vancouver is, that's 200,000 people. 200,000 people that are either suffering in silence, momentarily or not, that have been touched by it. That have, a lot of them, anyways, have been too ashamed to acknowledge it, to talk about it. So again, 200,000 people, if they just started to talk honestly with their friends, their family, and just say, this is what I'm dealing with, then the education starts. Basically, we would be, the education of just educating the general public, if these 200 people sort of bring it to light. Otherwise, like I said, it's this fraction of a percent that's portrayed on the TV that gets to do the educating. And not to mention, the unfortunate souls on the downtown east side where you're now seeing, some poor man or woman in the last stages of their life, that have been preyed upon by drug pushers and stuff like that, and their mental illness, of course, is exasperated. So these are the three educating components. Unless the vast majority of people that are dealing with the affliction speak about it, it's going to be constantly, the stigma won't go away, because the story of it being a violent, completely debilitating, thing that you have to fear, we'll carry on to do the educating.
Now, you're close to young people, but with your career in teaching, do you see a lack of awareness about mental health issues in our schools?
Completely. Completely. And this is where the Canadian Mental Health Association is really trying to put their efforts in educating adolescents, in educating teachers to see if we can get it in, age-appropriate curriculums, educating parents. To give you an idea, people say, well, it's not a really dangerous or a really, what's the word, dangerous, debilitating. Let's go to the extremes here. adolescents 15 to 25, I believe. It's the second highest killer of adolescents after cars, suicide, right? Mm-hmm. So one would think that if parents were aware and adolescents were aware, you know, and friends could communicate, we could bring down that suicide rate. In fact, talking about suicide, which is just an unfortunate subject, but it's a reality, there are more suicides in this country than homicides. And you don't have to take my word for it. It's online. It's from the Canadian Mental Health Association. So here we are building, I think Harper wants to build $5 billion worth of new prisons. Well, if a fraction of that were put into education, were put into something like this, a lot of sensitive, very interesting people could, you know, not leave us and continue to be productive members of society. I know in the States the suicide rate is also larger than the homicide rate. Of course, their rate of suicide and homicide is much, much higher than ours because of guns and the lax gun laws. But what you don't hear is that 70 to 80% of gun deaths in the state are self-inflicted. 70 to 80%. But again, the media will have you believe that the mentally ill create victims rather than being victims of themselves or victims of, you know, some drug pusher on the downtown east side, etc. It's complete BS, actually. The whole thing's ridiculous.
So you leave August 1st, right?
I leave August 1st from the art gallery to enjoy a great ride, and the website, ridedon'thide.com, gives people a chance to tell their story of what mental illness is and how it's afflicted them. So we get a bit of a more, like I said, a humanitarian voice to this. And 24 Hours has been very generous to allow me to write a column every 2 weeks from the road. And I've got a great group of a team of IT guys and people that are mapping and people that are doing the logistics, so that all I have to do is focus on writing.
Well, what do you pack for a trip like this? I mean, you obviously have to pack light, right?
Yeah, exactly. Very light. I love traveling on a bike. I mean, I love traveling. I'm sure most of your listeners do. And there's something beautiful about traveling on a bike. You're going fast enough to cover some great distances. People think that it's slow. I mean, sure, compared to a plane that's slow, but, you know, 100 kilometers a day is not difficult to do. So it's about seeing a certain area, typically anyways, it's about seeing a certain area a little bit more thoroughly than rushing through a certain land or part of geography. And the beauty of biking allows your senses to really get live. So you're taking in the sights, the smells, the sounds, and getting to your point about traveling light, you're a minimalist. Every little compartment has got a special spot for something. So it's, you know, one quick dry collared shirt, something from Tilly's or something like that I don't have to iron. One pair of slacks that, again, are quick dry. A couple pairs of socks, biking gear, tools for the bike so that you're not stranded somewhere. In this case, on this trip in particular, I've got a sort of a whole technology bag, you know, from the netbook, the solid state netbook, to the GPS and things like that. And you try to go light, and the tent, the sleeping bag, and then you're off.
Now you're going. It's just over a year that you're on this trip, right?
Exactly. That's the goal, to do the equatorial distance of 40,000 kilometers, which is once around the planet, in 400 days.
And how many of the days are you actually riding, and how much of the day are you riding?
Right, good question. I have to average 108 kilometers a day. That doesn't take into account flights or, you know, obviously needed rest time. So I'm breaking it down to have a fifth day off, a fifth day completely resting, no cycling whatsoever. In order for me to make my 108 kilometers a day average, I have to cycle 135 kilometers for 4 days in a row, 135 each, and then I get the fifth day off. Now, on the days of cycling, it's usually, you know, get up before dawn or right around dawn and cycle, take a break at noon. Especially some of these parts of the world are going to be extremely hot, so it'll be about cycling, you know, well before dawn, and definitely not cycling near noon. The question of how long it takes is obviously depends on how long or how fast you're cycling. I'm a bit older than when I cycled across Canada, so I'm not going to blow out my knee or you know, wreck any tendons or anything like this. So the idea is to take it really easy at the start. I've got to still do the 135 kilometers. kilometers a day, but no one's telling me to rush it. So those first couple weeks, I'm basically cycling from dawn to dusk. So the only thing that might be sore is my butt, but I'm not putting too much exertion on my legs. It's an aerobic activity, but low impact. So by keeping the revolutions nice and easy, I get my 135 kilometers done, but do not strain. And then after about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, something magical starts to happen, and you just become this fine-tuned machine. You just sort of meld with your bike, and you know your body stops complaining, and you stop complaining, and then you start to pick up the pace. So the 135 kilometers can take, you know, 6 hours optimally, I guess, if I'm hitting, you know, 25 kilometers an hour with the wind behind me. It's 6 hours of cycling.
And along the way, when you're in, whether you're in Chile or in Egypt or in Russia,
right,
or Colombia, will you be talking to people about what you're doing?
I've got a publicist that's looking into that. If given the possibility, I definitely will. I'm not foolish in the sense that I'm not going to go into some third world country as this white guy, white privileged man from Canada, and start, you know, espousing that I know what to do with their medical problems. It's more about reporting, I guess, back to the Vancouver community, back to whoever is interested in the blog or the Twitter, that this is what I'm seeing. Now, if we successfully, you know, I presume probably more likely in English-speaking countries like Australia, and Australia is halfway, I'm done about 20,000 kilometers when I'm in Sydney. So, you know, if there's an appetite for that, then I will speak, gladly speak to schools or to people out there. Because I think that the issue is global. The issue of fear and the stigma of mental illness is global. Everything works out all right, and I'm finishing up the trip next summer. Then, again, if the publicity machine works well and does its job, then there'll be, you know, some more chances to speak out against this ridiculousness.
And then the other thing, when we go to ridehigh.com and we make a donation, all of the money goes to the Canadian Mental Health Association, right?
Yeah, the BC division. Thank you very much for making that, bringing that to light. I've saved up my money for this trip. I've taken my time off, and I'd have it no other way. None of your listeners are funding my holiday. It's all going to the Canadian Mental Health Association. And it's through a wonderful, I believe it's called CanadaGives.org, CanadaHealth.org, I can't believe I've forgotten the name. But basically it's a Canadian organization that is the intermediary from things like the BC Cancer Institute or Canadian Mental Health Association, where basically you click on their link, and then they send the funds to the Canadian Mental Health Association.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very happy not to be touching the money.
Yeah, I when I went on the website there to make my donation, it's very easy. I mean, it takes less than 5 minutes to do it.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Will you miss Vancouver?
Oh, I always miss Vancouver when I travel. We live in arguably the most gorgeous place in the world. I miss my friends. I miss my family. I miss my girlfriend. I look forward to keeping in touch with people via the internet. As you said, I mean, times have changed. The world's a small place. I know it's a cliche, but truly, with internet cafes everywhere and handheld PDAs, you're never really alone. So I'll miss Vancouver. Yeah. And at other times, to be honest, I'm just anxious to get on the road and to have the silence to be away from it all and just by myself.
You're likely busy preparing for the first, so you're good to come on today. We'll be following you on the website, and congratulations on doing this, and best of luck, Michael.
Hey, thanks, Joseph. It's been a privilege.
You're very welcome. The website for more is ridedonthide.com, and visit it regularly and do make a donation. Michael Schrader on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Lanto.